Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, Ralph Gerke is speaking on archaeology and the Bible, ancient Israel's golden age. So let's listen in on Ralph Gerke.
What we should like to do today is continue our discussions and, if possible, make this survey of, complete the survey of pre-Israelite Palestine. And then get into the Golden Age. I hope we can get into David and Solomon and the Temple, when they were really a great empire. Before I do that, though, I'm going to give you a little armchair archaeology. I usually like to do that to my groups, because I think they get a bit of a flavor of hands-on archaeology. So,
thank you.
Maybe, would you be so kind as to pass them on to each person, and I'll take care of some light so that people can see what they have. And put what's left on the table here. Just stand up and go all the way around. That might be the easiest way to do it.
Thank you.
What you have here is a group of four pieces of pottery, and what I'd like to do is play a little game with you, what I call an imagination game, so that you might think a little. Well, the first one at the upper left-hand corner is a Canaanite wand. You have enough there for yourself? Okay. And it's, I put down in the 13th century, you see that? And so this would be the time when, well, let's take, for instance, Gideon and Joshua came in, and there's a man, a judge, or a deliverer called Hefti Ehud. First of all, I'd like to ask you, what is the function of that figure 64? What do you think it is?
It's a glass, isn't it?
It's not made of glass, no.
Well,
a grail.
It's the 64th one you found.
Pardon?
64th piece of pottery you found.
No. This is just a figure from a diagram. You see that?
Oh.
Yeah.
Something they drink? Is it something they drank out of?
Yes, I think it's a cup. Don't you think so?
Yeah. It's real.
And that means that it comes not from the ordinary house, but it comes from?
Temple.
Well, maybe the temple, but maybe a palace, you see that, or someone that really is wealthy. And if you want to say which biblical person might have used it, if it's Canaanite, and it came there, do you think that it might have been used at the time when Rahab the harlot had Joshua, at the time of Joshua, kept the spies? If she had a kind of a drinking establishment? That's what one student once told me. I got a real bang out of that. I hadn't thought of that myself. Maybe it could be that the great big fat king of Moab, who had come to Jericho and had conquered it, and he was later stabbed by the deliverer Ehud. He might have used it. In other words, you have to use your imagination for something like that, see? Now that's perhaps our first example. Why don't you take the next example, and there is figure 65, and it's Philistine. It comes from a little later period, the 11th century, and notice it has beautiful swans on it, doesn't it? First of all, the function. What do you think that thing is used for?
Looks like a canteen. Or
wine jug.
Yeah, it's for pouring wines into goblets, don't you think so?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so it's very, very nice, and it's much better pottery than the Israelites ever made, these Philistines. This is true. It's almost eggshell thin and beautiful. They just know how to do it. Now, do you know any Bible stories that this might fit into? We're just kind of teasing a little.
Samson,
precisely. Maybe when he went down to get that girl whose name was Delilah, which in Hebrew means spit girl. So that was maybe at the wedding. Well, we're teasing, you see that. There was also a Philistine king by the name of Nabal who entertained David, and David worked down there. And one of David's wife came down there at Ziklag. Or it could have been, this is a terrible thing, that when the Philistines cut off the head of King Saul, the first king, and celebrated they nailed his body to a temple and they celebrated this thing. They might have had something like that. You see what I'm trying to do here? I'm trying to put the archaeology together. Can you pass this to that lady back there? Thank you.
Thank you.
Another nice speaker. Okay, the next one, a figure 66, is certainly, well, what's its function? What do you think that is?
Water.
Slurring water.
You remember I brought some pieces of pottery the first day that came from those big jars for storing things, staples, either dry grain or olives, raisins, or wet wine, I suppose, maybe beer. I don't know. Well, if, what do you think? Which Bible person, if this is Iron Age 1, and that would be, now we're getting into, I didn't put down the century, this would be just before David. Well, let's say, for instance, that we're found at a place called Gibeah, and that's where Saul had his first capital, his palace, then it might be connected with those Bible stories. You see that? So you see how we can do this with archaeology connected with the biblical materials. Or maybe if it was found at Megiddo in Iron Age 2, and it was very similar, then maybe it was where when Solomon, David had conquered the place and Solomon built it up, or maybe even Ahab had control of that. I showed you some pictures of that once. We don't know that. Now, the last one is figure 61. And first of all, what do you think the function of that is? It's very elegant, isn't it?
It looks Egyptian to me.
No, it actually, well, there would be things like down in Egypt. I think that's right. There was international commerce, like we have international trade. Something is made in Greece and it's sold in Egypt, you know, that sort of thing. But let's ask the question, first of all, function.
How big is it?
That's very good. I would imagine it would be about this high.
Oh, and it has a lid.
Pardon?
And it has a lid.
No, it doesn't have a lid. It's open mouthed.
Oh.
In fact, you can kind of tell there are four perspectives. You have a broad side view, you know.
Yeah.
And you have both an inside and an outside one.
Yeah.
And then you've got a view of the top. You see that?
Yeah. Oh.
You see how that top is, and then you can also see the thickness, even the thickness of the handle, isn't it? That's a typical way in which they publish these things. So if they have just one picture, they can picture the type of pottery that we have to see. And
it could be pouring water.
This happens to be from the late Bronze Age, the 13th century. Yes.
You could pour water out of it.
Water, yes. They seldom drank water.
That's true.
You know, you get your tummy. They seldom drank water alone. And this is elegant. I don't think in a palace or something you would have mixing water and wine. You know, they seldom drank wine straight. We do, because of all kinds of things like that. But even in the Roman Mass, which goes back to the earliest Roman days, there are still canonical laws that have not been changed to the Mass of this day, that the wine which the priest has is always water. Thank goodness for the priest who had to consume as much equal wine and water. Some of the priests really had trouble, you know. They went to seminary, they had to learn how to drink wine, because that was part of it, or otherwise you'd have real trouble. Many of them had a lot of trouble with stomachs and things like that. Well, now, this is for mixing water and wine at a banquet, see? So that's, this is the time of Joshua. What's maybe for a banquet? I don't know whether Joshua celebrated his victories and the sun stood still and so forth with that. I have no idea. But I let my students run wild with something like that. They usually come up with better answers, but I'm not giving you guys any marks here in this class. Anyone have any questions about this?
What was the purpose of mixing water and wine? To dilute it so they wouldn't get so drunk, or they didn't have so much wine to go around?
I think both. It's just this was the custom. And it's still in Roman canonical law, it's still a custom in this day.
Which century did this come from?
Pardon?
When did this date from? When does it date from? How old is it?
Oh, it's the 13th century, late Bronze Age, so about 1200. To the very end of the Bronze Age. I'll put this up on the board again because we did this last time and I think it'll survey for the slides that we're going to show. I'm going to begin with some of the Stone Age things. Now, I don't have anything from the Paleolithic age, the Old Stone Age, nor do I have anything in this collection in Palestine. Things have been found there, but I don't have any in my collection in, well, it's called the Mesolithic Middle Stone Age, or the New Stage Neolithic. You've heard of Neolithic, haven't you? Yeah, because that's the New Stone Age. And then you have the so-called Chalcolithic or Copper, that's the middle of the first used, the Copper Stone Age. And I'll have some things of that, but just a few of them. But when we really start here, I think you would ask, what is the date, Steve, of this beginning of Bronze Age? Can anyone tell me why is bronze quite different from anything that was copper or stone? What makes bronze so important?
Well, it's easier making, it holds together better.
That's right.
Not so expensive, too.
Yes?
Well, you don't have to have such a high fire. In order to melt copper, you have to have a very hard fire with bellows and so forth. Whereas bronze, it's easier malleable, you see that? And so that simply took over.
And so we simply called it early bronze, EB, and we don't have to know the dates here. If you want a chart with all the dates, it's way over there in an archaeological chart that I put on the table there, so that'll give you all the details that you want, maybe more than you want. Then comes Middle Bronze Age. Remember we said this is the time of Abraham? And then comes the Late Bronze Age, if you want to talk to the time of Joshua. And only then, of course, when Joshua conquers the wheat in the Iron Age, really began to have, we'll say about 1200 B.C., do you have the beginning of the conquest and the settlement of the people. And then you have the first king, and well, let's just put the dates down here. David and Solomon, and then all the rest of the kings that followed. And then they went into exile. They were really only a small time here that they were very strong. And then this is kind of the Persian period, so they're no longer controlling their own destiny. And then after the Persians come the Greeks. And they have a short time when they have the Maccabees here when they're free. And then the Romans come. And the Romans take over this province, and that's the one we have at the time of Christ, isn't it? Now, we're not going to go that far. I don't know just how far we'll go through our slides today, but I'm quite sure that we'll get pretty close to David here. So let's put David. If you want to know, as a boy, I think I learned that if you put Abram as 2000 and Joshua 1500, that's a little early for him, and David at 1000, it's easy to remember. You see that? You can kind of get those times. But we're interested more in archaeological periods. Are there any other questions before we look at the slides? And though there are slides, and I'll stop at certain points for questions, please ask questions during this time. See that? So we'll try to get a little more of not theoretical. I'll start out a bit theoretical. When I was a boy, I think was taught by very good people that the world was created in 4004. Because in the King James edition of the Bible, it wasn't in the original King James that we used in northern Wisconsin, the dates were given for all these things according to Fisher's 4004. And they said that the real big event that happened in Genesis 11 was the Tower of Babel. And this is a picture by Regal the Elder. It's a wonderful picture of when the nations wanted to keep their unity after the flood, and they built this tower that would go up into heaven and would kind of unify the whole area. And Regal had been out in Rome, and he saw some of the Colosseum remnants, and he used that as his example. But it's a beautiful picture, and you have here the Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And of course, from Shem came the Semites, the Israelites. From Ham came the black people. And from Japheth came the white people. Well, here happens to be the bad person, Ham, who was in control of this project. Now, this is nothing but a medieval legend. And according to this legend, it's not really what the Bible says. But legends sometimes are more important for people's understanding, popular understanding, that the original language of the world was that of the Semites was Hebrew. And that all the other languages were changed. You've heard this story, haven't you? The Tower of Babel.
Right.
And that after they couldn't communicate, you know, someone asked for bricks and they set up bananas. They didn't understand one another. Then what happened? There was a confusion. We talked a little about the nature of these master stories in Genesis. And I put it down in the master story as I would understand it on one of these handouts here, that the Tower of Babel, Babel means confusion, is mankind's paradoxical unity and disunity. We are all one, and still there are many groups and many nations. Well, people used to put this on a timeline, and what they did then is to kind of explain this, except that the more they did this, it just didn't work out. After they found out how many tribes there were in the 17th century, one of the Jesuit fathers wrote, he said, there are many, many more nations and tribes that are mentioned in Genesis chapters 10 and 11. And we had to realize that. So today, when we start, let's say, with finding a time, we can't really use what some people have still tried to use, all the numbers in Genesis 5 and in Genesis 11. I think you perhaps know what I'm talking about, but I'll explain it. And simply say, well, Abraham lived 130 years, and then he begat his son, Seth, and after that, he lived 800 years, so all the years of Abram, or of Adam rather, are 930 years and he died. And that's the way it goes all the way through it. They tried to have the longest one was the man who died perhaps in the flood, and that was Methuselah. You've heard of that, haven't you? Yeah. But they used this as a chronology. As we said this morning, and some of you were in the session about the feeding of the 5,000 and the 4,000. That if this seems to be, and that's the way I have worked it out, I don't think we have to go through all the figures, but if you're interested in that, I feel that if you take all of these into a kind of cosmic Sabbath that puts everything very important at the Sabbath, which came at Mount Sinai, and put all of creation before that time and all of creation after that time, and then they expected that creation's consummation would come at their year 4,000. And I think that's the pattern. That's the best I can do it. When students ask me, what did that really mean? Did Adam live that long? No, I said, I think the way they use numbers, it means something like this, that Adam lived a long time, and sometimes it's even increased with sevens. You remember, well, let me just recall, some of you studied this. How long did Enoch live before he was translated to heaven? 365. What does that mean?
A year.
That's how many days there are, and not a moon year, which was one of their years, but they...
A solar year,
see? Or the godless person, the father, Lamech, the goddess Lamech, lived 777 years. And you see, these numbers are used a little differently than we used. You've seen others, you see that. So today, in archaeology, we can't use this as the pattern for our timeline. And so the oldest pattern, one of you spoke to me about this, is carbon 14. There are new radionomic ways of dating things even today, which I don't have any charts on in myself. I'm not a scientist, I don't understand it. But you've heard of carbon 14, haven't you? That every living creature has two types of carbon, carbon 12, which is stable, and carbon 14, which is nuclear and sends all its rays out, isn't it? And with a Geiger counting by comparing the two types, how much is stable and how much has been lost, you can kind of data, you see that. And so if, for instance, that tree over there, or even the cow, has so much of that carbon-14 in it, and by relating that to the stable carbon-12, you can see how long it takes before that carbon-14 has simply evaporated. But that's a very general and a very scientific way of doing it. And I think in the scientific age, we have to kind of do that. But please don't expect the Bible to do that. They just had no those things. We also have, and this is very important, we have these electronic microscopes, don't we? And they're able to take out pollen from all these layers. So that with the newest archaeology, we actually have what they call archaeobotany, in other words, a botany that goes back and even goes to the pollen. And this is very important because it can tell in Palestine when there was a rainy season and when there was a dry season. See? Now, what we are interested in now is perhaps some of the oldest material that we can find. And when you ask what's the oldest things, it happens to be a Mount Carmel in the caves. Where in a cave, and this is, we just, excuse me,
same thing here.
Thank you, last time. Okay. I guess. I think you know how that's done. I think you've got layers and you go down. The lowest of these stones would be very, very different than those that are much more refined that are used here. To see that?
It went off.
It went off, okay.
There, now it's going. When that light is flashing.
Is it all right now?
No, it's all right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I have to put this on a little better than I did last time.
Did you pick your pocket?
Yes, but it broke last time, it broke it, and my pocket is broke. It fell off. So I'll put it here, and I think it might be a little bit on my bed. Okay. Let's see. I lost my...
It's behind you from the chair.
Oh, yes, thank you. So, in other words, we have this sort of thing. Well, we're used to that from American archaeology, aren't we? Caves and things like that? I think so. That's common. They do that in Palestine, too. When you come to a place where you have a lot of human habitation, the very best place for the Stone Age in Palestine is Jericho. You can see toward the left of this slide the mound from a little different angle than I showed it the other night. Toward the left is the greenery. That's where the Elisha's fountain is. And toward the right are the various cuttings. And in the inset shows you that tower. It comes from about 8,000 BC, and it is one of the oldest structures in the world. It was there when a population of, by this time this is Neolithic age, so it's a population of about 2,000 people were living. This is that Kathleen Kenyon's guess. It wasn't very many, but it was bigger than just a small village, you see that? And also they found in this layer, which you see down below, human skulls with inset eyes. So this is kind of Neolithic and quite old, some of the oldest stuff we have. This is an archaeological picture of really several things here.
Does it again?
Sorry. Yeah. You just have to put it in front of here.
Does it work?
Yes. Is it all right?
We lost the battery shield.
It's not off. It's not working now.
Can you take it off again?
Yes, sure. Mm-hmm. This man understands these modern. I appreciate this very much.
Where did you get it on?
Okay.
Hey, this is unplugged. And you need to put it in the back so when you bend over, you don't push it off.
All right.
Stick it behind you.
Thank you very much.
This tower, and this is kind of a nice diagram to show you the steps. There are about 22 steps inside of it. Was of course a watchtower to protect this settlement that had already domesticated plants and animals. And so there's no doubt about it that, here's the tower in this diagram, that by the time the early bronze wall was built here, this was quite old already, they incorporated it into their fortification into this wall. Then later on, they built this late bronze there, and there are some sections where they actually found things from that time. Maybe another diagram would be even a little more helpful. For this is a cut through based on Kathleen Kenyon's work through Jericho. If you cut through the mound in the way in which she did in her trial tinge, of course, what she was interested in is the oldest part, the Neolithic part. That's not quite as focused as it should be, is it? Maybe we can. Is that better?
Yes.
I'm sorry about this. Actually, what the problem is this is not long enough. If I pull it down, that's my problem. So the oldest section would have been this Neolithic that was pre-pottery, and then a little more Neolithic after that. Then the ancient bronze time, and a lot of the mound has eroded. The modern road is here, and the modern fountain is there. And the middle bronze is somewhat preserved here with a double wall, and we have part of it here, and a glass ceiling, part of it down here, kind of a curtain wall. They often had that. And then the section that she found that comes from the late Bronze Age, in the time of Joshua, was only found at this point. Iron Age later came. But that gives you a pretty good idea of what was there in the mound. I took this picture myself while she was working there in 1954. You notice what's happening way up to the right here? This is kind of an interesting archaeological thing. This is the foundation stone. What's here? Bricks, isn't it? And they're preserved. Then what do they do here?
Stones.
They build it up. They put stone foundation and then they build bricks again. If you look way past where these men are working there, see part of the old wall? That's part of the oldest wall of Jericho. So that can give you some idea of what Jericho was long before Joshua and long before the Israelites took over. Well, now a few things that came from her excavations. This happens to be a pestle for grinding. What do you think they're grinding in?
Grain.
Herbs.
Herbs, grain, we would think that today. Actually, it was when they were still food gatherers, things that had to do like primitive, the not domesticated cereals or anything like that, but they're beginning to gather these things, trying to collect them, you see that? So this comes from the time of hunters and gatherers in Jericho. And here you come from the time when they certainly have produced domesticated plants and animals, grain, and they are grinding them in very nice grinders. So this is much nicer. And this comes, of course, from later period. This is a goddess that's found in Neolithic times in Jericho. Notice how it's put together rather crudely, isn't it? But there's a way of comparing this to what you would find
everywhere else in the ancient Neolithic world. Look at the eyes, look at the nose. But it seems to be a fertility goddess. This certainly is a fertility goddess. And notice that on her head she has one of those large jars in which you can make milk into butter. You see that by shaking it. It's almost made like a skin, but it has that formation. What she has underneath her right arm, I don't know. But that is one of the things that was found there and in a cave, which is very remarkable. It's in the Israel Museum today. Now, there was a place nearby, on the other side of the Jordan, in what is now the Kingdom of Jordan, actually the Kingdom of King Hussein, called Gazul. And the Mr. Sulan, that man commissioned by the American Institute of Archaeology to make as good reconstructions as we can of the ancient pottery, you can see they have pottery, and of the things that they found on the wall. They found a painting. Can you see the painting on the back of the wall? It's beautiful. In the Kol Biblik in Jerusalem, it's put in the Jesuits' sitting room as a very, very nice thing, because the Jesuits found that there. And it's maybe a stock. And the people in the background on the wall, that's just what they found, had masks on them. They must be dancing and singing about certain myths. You see that? Certain stories. And these would be stories about the gods and goddesses long before Abram and the Israelites came along. What's that?
A ram.
A ram. And you know what a ram is, or a bull is, that's fertility. You see that? And there's also what? Libation, you see that? This also comes from that Gazulian period. And now we're finally going to get into the copper. This is copper Stone Age. This was found in a cave way down near the Dead Sea. And it had been put there, but those are marvelously made things. They're made of pure copper. Some of them seem, we don't know how they were used. This might have been a kind of a staff, a kind of to show your symbolic as they acted out these myths. And these are maces. I suppose you put one on top of the other, you can bash some of these brains out with it like a ball. And these are birds here, as you can see. These are entrances. What this is, we don't know. Some people think they put it on their heads in their ceremonies. There are a lot of gazelles running around there. And here you can see the gazelles too. And what it is, there's no writing, so we can't tell. But we know that this comes from that copper stone age. When we get to the early Bronze Age, which is the time when urbanism began, they really began to not only have domestication, but they had a surplus of agriculture. They could trade. And they had all kinds of other things they could trade with down to Egypt. And so there was a trade with early Egypt. We find, in fact, some of these artifacts in the places down in Egypt. This is an incense burner. This is put for the draft here. You put your incense up here. And so it must be from part of a worship place. Most of them have kind of a calyx, we call it, almost like a lily flower opening here. And there are various types of jars. This is just a little assemblage of early Bronze Age, just to give you some idea. One of the largest cities that had never had many other layers put on top of it is Erbil. So we are in the desert, and therefore well preserved. But it was a tremendous city. Almost about 60 acres that was surrounded by a wall with all kinds of towers all the way around it. And they collected in the middle of it a reservoir. It took me about a day of traveling to get to this isolated place, but I got there and paid a taxi to take me home and get me back from a nearby city in Israel. But I was glad to see it. Now, this is an older, in fact, this is the archaeologist's picture. You can see this is a place of human habitation. So we kind of know how they live, including temples. It was a reservoir where they collected all the rainwater for the seasons when it didn't rain. And you had a palace. You had a lot of people that controlled the water. A social irrigation. In fact, it was during this age, the early Bronze Age, that most of the strategic places in Palestine first got their settlements, because these people found the wonderful places and began to build the cities. So this is a real beginning of urbanism. And these are some of their pottery. What's this? Everybody should know this.
For drinking?
No.
Lamp?
A lamp, yes. Mm-hmm. And you put your olive oil inside of it, and you put
wicks
on the inside. So it's for wick power, for candle power. See that? So many watts. And these are, of course, other typical. Notice that they're, the tops of them, that seem to be the style at this time, pretty well elongated. So when you find something like this, you know that you're getting into the Middle Bronze Age. Now, in the Middle Bronze Age, it seems to be the place that we can put Abram, and remember, he's the father of the chosen people. Remember, we went back to him. And he was a nomad, and as you can see here, the nomads lived in tents, and they moved from place to place, the way Abram is pictured in Genesis. And they come near to places where there are city-states, these cities, and they can put in a crop in the spring of the year, and then they come back, they maybe have a cave to bury their dead. This tradition, they had pretty good relations with the city next door, usually, the way Abram often did in the Bible. And so this, what we find from this age, the Middle Bronze Age, helps us perhaps as a background for the Bible. Even today, you can find these little tents down there. They're made of the dark camel hair, and we actually walked to some of them. As I told the people the other night, you'll sometimes over today find a Toyota next to it. And sometimes a man goes to work in for the Israeli construction work. You see that? And that's the way it is. So it's not pure nomadism moving around. Of the four boys that I had working for me in my dig, one of them was a Bedouin. And the farmer boys, the Falim, treated him quite differently than they would treat their fellows. And he was lower class, without a doubt. Then they gave him all the menial tasks. I never liked it. In Egypt, in some of the tombs from this time, we have pictures of people coming from Canaan down into Egypt. And here are some of them. As at the left, you can see even a man with a lyre singing. He's singing some of these songs. That's interesting. On his donkey, there's a bellows. So they're iron workers. They know how to do this. Then there come the women and the colorful garments, little boys, another donkey with the bellows again, and then the men with spears. Is this the way Abram looked when he came down, very briefly, down into Egypt? Or is this the way later on of the descendants of Jacob, when they went down to the land of Goshen, looked? Coats of many colors at the right, you see? This could well be. The National Geographic's wonderful book called A Great Bible, A Great People of the Bible and How They Live, unfortunately it's out of print, but you can find it in many good libraries, and it's worthwhile looking at, had this reconstruction of Abram with his family, a large family, including his nephew Lot, setting out toward, as a nomad, toward Palestine, and living in various places. How do you like that for a piece of pottery? That is found at Jericho in this Middle Bronze Age and is a portrait perhaps the man that was buried there, a Canaanite nobleman with the Bronze Age kind of vapor, which is tragic, isn't it? And when Kathleen Kenyon found in an, oh, by the way, this is another a picture of a Middle Bronze Age city. Notice it has two walls, an upper wall and an lower wall, and a kind of an apron in between, isn't it? So in the Middle Bronze Age, there had been a little slack off. They had a long kind of troubles. But now they're restoring, and they're making their cities even stronger than the early Bronze Age people ever had them see. So this is maybe what Thomas Shechem looked like when Abram went past it. This is at least the American excavators from Chicago feel it looked like that. And this is what Kathleen Kenyon has in the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem for the Middle Age. She found a tomb, and they found all these things here, including the skeletons of these three people. And they found the jars, and a wonderful artist put it all together. They found the remains of this chair. They found even these playthings that the children had. So we don't always know, we don't have anything from Abram himself, but we know the type of life that the patriarchs lived as Nineveh. We find this sort of thing, and this is found in Megiddo. Notice a cup. And if you roll it out like this, what do you think you can see there? There must be some sort of a story, some sort of a myth, isn't it? Can you see that there are very odd creatures? Some have two heads. They can look at the front and the back, like Janus in Egypt, and odd creatures. Then you have serpents. Remember them? Then you have, this obviously is maybe the sun, don't you think so? Or some star. And then a group of stars here. And then, but there's no writing there. And without writing, you're not going to be able to interpret it. You see that? Unless we find some writing that fits this. So this is the nature of much of the evidence from such a time. When you get now to this late in this Middle Bronze Age, the Hyksos come. They were people who first had horses and chariots. They even had them before the Egyptians. They came from the north. We don't know where they came from. They conquered all of these cities, in this case, Hazor. And they even went down and invaded Egypt and controlled Egypt for about 200 years. The Egyptians don't like to talk about that because they had been conquered by other people. And later, they drove them out, and they kind of destroyed all remnants of these leaders who came here. But this was a revolution to have a man not just shooting his arrow from standing position, but moving. You see that? So that's where they could control many things. And this would be one of the main cities way up in the north, north of Galilee, not far from the border toward Syria and Damascus. And here you have the inner city with its towers. This apron that we saw before, the other, and a double gate, and all the type of pottery. They have beautiful pottery here. It's burnished. Some of it is eggshell thin, and it's quite more sophisticated than any of the pottery they had before. Now, when the Egyptian pharaohs drove out those Hyksos, those foreign kings, they not only just drove them out of Egypt, they drove them out of all of Canaan and Palestine. And we have actually stories of the great man, Thutmose III, he's the great conqueror, the Napoleon of Egypt, you might call him, pictured something like this, on a chariot, conquering those men in the foreground that are Canaanites. And he tells a whole story about his campaign in Palestine at Megiddo, the famous place that we know. He describes how everybody else was afraid, But he was not as afraid as his generals, and he trusted his God, his all, with Egyptian culture, and finally won the battle. And this is a man by the name of Herbert, that the American Institute of Archaeology in an earlier edition had they commissioned him to make these wonderful pictures. Later on, when the Egyptians went way up to the northern border to the Hittites, that's in Turkey, they fought there, and this man is a different pharaoh, Ramses II, and those are Hittite men coming there to make a peace treaty. And we know they exchanged princesses, in other words, wives, and they kind of cemented their treaty in that way. We know what type of trees they had, and so when Moses comes to Mount Sinai and makes a treaty and a covenant, he uses the same pattern that they used in making treaties in those days, because we have those treaties. They would usually inscribe them on permanent material so that they would last, sometimes on walls of rock near the modern city of Ankara, the capital city of Turkey.
Yes. Are these Susan treaties?
Pardon?
Susan treaties?
Yes, these are sometimes they're parody. These would be, I think, more of a parody. These are equals. They fought each other to a standstill. Now, they wouldn't accuse, they wouldn't say it that way, you see that. But they had fought one another, and then they made a treaty. You're right, there are two types of treaties. A suzerain, where a suzerain gives it to you, or the other one is between equals, you see that?
That's right.
There are two types of those treaties.
Correct.
I was at this temple, this is the reconstruction of it, down at Thebes in Egypt, and I spent a whole day there. It is so large that people say that of the things that you can see from the moon with the naked eye of human construction, one would be the Great Wall of China, the other would be the temple of the Ram God at Thebes in Egypt. So all of the booty that these pharaohs won up there in Canaan, they sent down a good share of it to the priests at this place in Thebes in Egypt. And that's tremendous. The result of that war and the booty was there. Even a queen, they had a queen by the name of Hatshepsut, and she built a beautiful palace. If any of you have been in Egypt or were there in Egypt, you want to see that. But it all has relationship to things that happened in Palestine. Well, don't we have a story about that man sitting there? That's actually Joseph. He's doing what?
Collecting the grain.
He's collecting grain. Remember his brothers go out there and they get grain down in Egypt. Egypt always has a flood. And when they have a drought in Canaan, they go down there. And that's from that wonderful great people of the Bible and how they live a National Geographic. And here's another National Geographic reconstruction of a fortress on the border between Egypt and Canaan. And there you see some people passing it. We actually had Egyptian documents that were told from such a fortress that told about Bedouin that crossed over. So it's not unnatural that the Israelites, the forefathers of the Israelites, would go down and finally even live in Egypt. And if Joseph worked in the house of Potiphar, maybe he worked in that sort of a house, because such mansions have been excavated in Egypt. So when we talk about biblical archaeology, we include many places besides Palestine. We must know something about Egypt, about Syria, later on even about Greece. Well, you've heard of the Red Sea. I don't know how many of you have heard that the name Red Sea is really a translation from the Greek. The Hebrew says Reed Sea. Some of you have heard of that, haven't you? Reeds are there in the estuary of the Nile. And here is a reconstruction from that same book of the Egyptians trying to pursue the Israelites and getting, when the Lord sends that east wind, getting mired there and drowning in the sea. Here's a picture of the big tent that the Lord said after they had made the covenant at Mount Sinai that he would come and dwell in their midst. They lived in movable tents, and the Lord had that too. You've all heard of that, haven't you? And we know quite a bit about how they build those things. And this is a reconstruction by Mr. Sulan of the same thing. And in the foreground, Moses, perhaps in the garments at that time for a noble person, and the other people that are blowing the trumpets, because Moses had to say, "Rise up, O Lord, and let thy enemies flee before thee. Let them that hate thee flee before thy face." And now they begin their trek, leaving Mount Sinai, where they've been for a whole year, and they go up toward Palestine. And this is a picture again, a reconstruction of Joshua, the young man, and Moses, the old man. Moses is not permitted to cross the Jordan and to go into the Holy Land. But from the top of Mount Nebo, he can look not only down on the Israelite camp, but he can see the land. I've been at Mount Nebo, and it is true that you can see a tremendous amount of the land. And the Lord said, "Now, this is the land that will be given to your people." How do you like this picture of Joshua? It's by a man who, Mr. Rowe, who was once Time magazine cover artist. He didn't know much about the Bible, but he was interested. So he went down, he was living in Austin, Texas, to the Presbyterian Church that had the best Bible study series, and he really studied the Bible. And on his basis of just reading the Bible, he said, "This is the way you should look at Joshua. A man of war, you see that? Fighting. And who do you think are underneath those big stones in the background? That man who stole some of the sacred reed, even, and his family." It's a very, very interesting picture. And the reason I showed it is it simply makes people think a little more realistically about some of the Bible stories. Now, for a long time, it wasn't only after Joshua crossed and began the conquest, it took a long time for people to finally conquer the Canaanites. And here you have one of the battles at the time of Barak and Deborah, right in the valley of Esdraela, where the valley cliff, you can see they even have some armor. Canaanites are fighting against the Israelite creed fighters, and they're winning. The Canaanites had even chariots down there in the valley. But the Israelites were able, this is the time of the song of Deborah, a very, very old song in the book of Moses, where it's called the Book of Judges, or the Book of Deliverance. Very, very interesting story. And this is a picture of Gideon with his Israelite men behind him. Notice the Iron Age type of jar in which they hid all their torches. And ordinarily, would you have every man in a platoon carrying a torch for an army? No, you just have one, isn't it?
Right.
For the whole battalion. And here each one. And then you can see on these other mountains, Mount Tabor over here, and the middle mountain, the widow Jairus, the widow of Nain lived there, they were there, and the Midianites down below here, confused. This is just a kind of a battle picture, but I think it reflects very, very well what happened in this long struggle in what we call Iron Age 1. So you see we're moving kind of fast. During this time, a group of sea people came down the Mediterranean, and the foremost among them were the Philistines. They came with boats, almost like the Vikings later on came in Europe, as they didn't conquer things, and their boats had these odd prows. They had one advantage over the Canaanites. This is Ascalon, that city over there that's being conquered. Notice that the Philistine man in the foreground has a sword, which is not as heavy as the iron swords that the Roman legionaries had, were slashing sword. He's using a slashing sword, but there were picking swords. But if you had a man with iron equipment fighting against a man with bronze, the man with iron equipment would almost have it. If you have the story, famous story of Goliath had all armor in bronze, but his spear point was 4 pounds in weight and was all iron. It was an iron age. He was really well equipped. You really know that famous story about David and Goliath. And he was well equipped. Well, here the Philistines are coming. They actually went and conquered a good share of that coast. And they tried then to conquer the hill country and were the rivals. The Israelites were coming in from the east, and these people were coming in from the west. And for a long time, there's a lot of conflict. I already showed you in the handout today something like this, but here's the original. Except this one is a little different. What do you think that jar in the foreground is used for? It's got a strainer. It's for pouring out things. Yes. It's for barley beer. And so you don't get those those sharp things from barley in your mouth. Well, what do you call it?
Beards.
Yeah. And so I think that's what most scholars agree with. But then, isn't that beautiful art?
It's the same as indicated on this one on the
paper. Yes, it's very, very much.
Very
yeah.
Similar.
Yeah, that is a little different type of thing. That's for pouring wine. And this is maybe the beer party for all those GIs that they had in their army. And get them pretty high and pretty drunk, I don't know. Now, at McGill, they found that this layer, over in Iron Age 1 metal, on an ivory inlay into either furniture or bedrooms, we don't know which, this wonderful picture of the King of McGill. And he's sitting on a throne, and what's holding up his throne? A cherub, yes. There is no such creature, but it has human intelligence. It can fly like a bird and a lion. Well, you've heard of the Sphinx in Egypt, isn't it? It's the same thing, except that the head is a pharaoh with a beard. It's that sort of a creature. Well, it holds up. By the way, in the temple in Jerusalem, didn't you have cherubs?
Right.
Yes, absolutely. The Lord was sitting invisibly on the throne in the Holy of Holies, and what was the armchairs holding him up?
Cherubs.
The cherubs. So this is kind of the way in which they thought of things. And here is either a priest or a priestess, we don't know, giving some food. Here they bring some of that from the kitchen, it seems. I don't know what this is, a gazelle and a lion over in the kitchen, whether that's the pendulum. And here, of course, is what?
Musician.
I will say with long hair, as they have that. Notice that wherever there's emptiness, they'll put a bird or even a plant. They don't like to have any vacant space in this type of art, which is rather surprising. And way at the end of it, you can see, way at the right, a shield. Not a very big one. This would be all right. A shield of a man who's bringing captives. Are these Israelite captives? They may well be, because of circumcised. Although they weren't the only people circumcised. Most of us are hygienically circumcised as part of the medical. But here, this is usually religious of us. And here comes another, it could be the same person as the king of Megiddo, on a chariot with a horse, and has obviously conquered it. Megiddo held out for a long time. David.